D.C., making sure that our voices are heard and our agenda is clear, that we can't keep on letting people die and have lives diminished because of this injustice and because of poverty in this, the richest country in human history. How is it that we can have half of the U.S. population experiencing some form of poverty when it just doesn't have to be?
Reverend Dr. Liz Thea Harris, I want to thank you so much for being with us, joining us from West Virginia, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, also executive director of the Cairo Center at Union Theological Seminary here in New York. We will link to your Poor People's Pandemic report. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a news producer. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The series continues this month on Saturday, April 16th, with guitarist Pat Donahue. Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, weekly COVID-19 cases in Oregon climb 42%, the first increase since January. Two more GOP senators announce their support for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. And in international news, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky calls on the United Nations to do more in response to Russia's war crimes. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 5th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Weekly COVID-19 cases in Oregon rose for the first time in more than 2 months, as hospitalizations fell to their lowest point since July of last year. Oregon health officials reported about 2,000 additional coronavirus cases during the week ending Sunday, up 42% from the previous week. Until now, cases had dropped for 9 consecutive weeks in Oregon, plummeting from a high of more than 56,000 cases in a single week in January. Oregon Health and Science University has forecasted that the lifting of masking requirements, combined with the high infection rate of the Omicron BA2 subvariant, would produce a bump in COVID-19 hospitalizations. It will become evident in the coming weeks whether this bump will materialize, as an increase in hospitalization rates lags behind case growth. As of Monday, 99 people who tested positive for coronavirus are hospitalized in Oregon, including 16 patients in intensive care units. Hospitalizations in the state are at their lowest point since July of 2021. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Oregon has reported about 700,000 COVID-19 cases and more than 7,000 deaths. As of April 1st, Oregon has reported fully vaccinating about 68% of the state's population, while 7% are partially vaccinated. So far, just 38% of Oregon residents have received the recommended booster shot. A federal judge has certified a class action lawsuit in Oregon over the state's response to the COVID-19 pandemic inside prisons. The decision is thought to be the first ruling of its kind in the nation, where a federal judge has signed off on prisoners suing for damages over a state's pandemic response. In Oregon, more than 5,000 people have tested positive for the virus while in Department of Corrections custody, and 45 people have died. A group of adults in custody who contracted COVID-19 first sued the state in April of 2020, alleging culpability by Governor Kate Brown, Corrections Department Director Colette Peters, and Health Authority Director Patrick Allen, among other state officials. The lawsuit focuses on how the state centralized decision-making for all prisons through the Department of Corrections Agency Operations Center. By signing off on policies and procedures, the state's prison system created a top-down approach to managing the virus. In a 54-page ruling late Friday, U.S. Magistrate Judge Stacey Beckerman signed off on two separate classes. One is a wrongful death class that will include the estates of the 45 adults for whom COVID-19 caused or contributed to their death while in the state's custody. The other is a damages class that would include anyone incarcerated after February 1, 2020, who was diagnosed with COVID-19 at least 14 days after they were incarcerated. Attorneys who represent those in custody said, quote, "The fears we had in April 2020 about how incarcerated people would be affected by the pandemic have sadly come to pass. The impact of this disease and its mishandling by those in charge has been devastating to people in prison," end quote. The state could appeal the judge's ruling, settle, or take the cases to trial. The city of Portland is suing TriMet, the region's public transit agency. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
The city of Portland is suing TriMet, alleging shoddy workmanship on a Southeast Portland streetcar platform that could require $10 million in repairs. City attorneys filed the lawsuit in Multnomah County Circuit Court against TriMet as well as Stacy and Whitbeck, a California-based construction firm that specializes in large-scale transit projects. In 2013, the city, along with TriMet, started the East Side Close the Loop project, aimed at creating a full streetcar loop around Portland with a connection over the Tillicum Crossing Bridge. The plan included TriMet's hiring a firm to fix the city-owned platform near the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. TriMet hired Stacy and Whitbeck as the main contractor. A city-hired engineer later found multiple problems that appeared after the construction firm finished the job in 2015, noting cracks in part of the platform and other foundational flaws. The lawsuit states the company did not, quote, "perform the work in a professional and workmanlike manner," end quote. City attorneys allege TriMet failed to oversee the construction firm and ensure the work was up to their standards. The suit includes charges of negligence and breach of contract. Neither Stacy and Whitbeck nor TriMet have commented on the pending legislation. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday, urging them to take more action. Zelensky said the Russian military must be held accountable for war crimes and atrocities it has committed. His remarks came after reports of a mass killing of civilians by Russian forces in the city of Bucha, near the capital of Kyiv. Photos and videos showing dead bodies strewn on city streets have sparked international condemnation against Moscow. President Joe Biden on Monday accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of war crimes. Zelensky suggested that the Security Council cannot work effectively when Russia is one of its permanent members. The Biden administration plans to announce an additional sweeping sanctions package targeting Russia on Wednesday. Under the new measures, the U.S. will ban all new investment in Russia, increase sanctions on financial institutions and state-owned enterprises, as well as sanctions on its government officials and their family members. Zelensky has said that new sanctions are not enough to respond to the horrors committed by the Russian military. According to the UN, at least 1,400 civilians have been killed in Ukraine since the fighting began, with another 2,000 civilians injured. Experts have warned that the true numbers are likely far higher. Two more Republican senators have come out in support of the nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. This all but assures Jackson will be confirmed to the nation's highest court. Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Mitt Romney of Utah announced Monday night that they will vote to confirm Jackson. GOP Senator Susan Collins of Maine announced last week that she would also back Jackson. Both Collins and Murkowski said that they believe the Senate nomination process is broken, as it has become more partisan in the past several decades. All three Republicans said they did not expect to agree with all of Jackson's decisions, but that they found her well qualified. The senators announced their decisions ahead of a procedural vote to advance the nomination. The Senate's 53-47 vote Monday evening was to discharge Jackson's nomination from the Senate Judiciary Committee after the panel deadlocked on whether to send the nomination to the Senate floor. The committee vote, split along party lines, was the first deadlock on a Supreme Court nomination in three decades. Democrats hope to confirm Jackson by the end of the week. If confirmed, Jackson would become the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. She would also be the third Black justice and the sixth woman in the court's history. In addition, Jackson would be the first former public defender on the high court. The freeze on federal student loan payments is set to expire May 1st, affecting more than 36 million Americans. The moratorium has been in effect since early 2020 in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and there are concerns that lifting it now would cause additional hardships for people faced with higher costs for food, gas, and other necessities. Mary Sherman has more on the story.
More than 36 million people with federal student loan debt have not been required to make a payment for over 2 years, but that could soon change. A moratorium on federal student loan payments went into effect in March 2020 and has been extended 3 times with a current expiration date of May 1st. Rome Busa with Greater Cleveland College Access Organization College Now says the benefits of the freeze have been tremendous for borrowers.
Now, the flip side of that is, even though it's been a pause on the burden of repayment, it hasn't completely canceled it or taken it away. So at some point, some action needs to be taken on both the borrower's side and on the federal government side. Right now, everything's at a standstill, and there's really no solutions being provided.
There are calls for the Biden administration to issue some federal student loan forgiveness before the pause expires or to extend the moratorium, since Americans are now fighting inflation as they struggle to recover from pandemic economic losses. Private lenders who are not covered by the moratorium claim it's unfair for borrowers who don't need it and say it's driving down demand for their products. Busa explains there's also talk about changing federal loan interest rates and other policies to make sure calculations are more fair. And he believes what's more important is addressing the high price tag for a college education. The average cost has more than doubled since the start of the century and now stands at about $35,000 a year.
If the costs keep rising, then the student debt will also continue to rise because people need education to grow and to get a career. That need to educate oneself is never going to go away.
In the meantime, Busa urges borrowers to prepare for payments to resume and examine options to lower payments. Those include public service loan forgiveness and income-based repayment plans.
And all of those have kind of different calculations all based off of their income, which helps lower those payments. And it's possible to have a $0 payment under one of these income-driven plans, and those $0 payments actually count as an eligible payment towards their student loan.
He adds that College Now and other partners across the country can help student borrowers navigate the loan process. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
President Biden calls Vladimir Putin a war criminal, and the U.S. spent more than $265 million in weapons disposal last year. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. President Joe Biden charged Russian President Vladimir Putin with war crimes Monday. The declaration came after numerous reports of Russian troops killing civilians in a village just west of Kyiv.
We have to gather all the detail so this can be an actual, have a war crime trial. This guy is brutal, and what's happening in Bucha is outrageous.
Biden told reporters he would seek further sanctions in response to the attacks. Politico reports the European Union is considering a ban on Russian oil as war crimes charges grow. The State Department has released the 21st edition of its annual To Walk the Earth in Safety report, which details the nation's efforts to dispose of, quote, illicitly proliferated and indiscriminately used conventional weapons of war, unquote, such as unexploded landmines and munitions. Bonnie Jenkins with the department says the U.S. is the world's largest financial supporter of weapons destruction, having invested more than $4.2 billion since the early 1990s.
In 2021 alone, the United States funded conventional weapons destruction in 62 countries with more than $265 million.
The House's Rules Committee yesterday considered contempt of Congress charges for two former Trump allies who have allegedly failed to comply with subpoenas from the January 6th committee. Last month, the January 6th committee voted unanimously to recommend contempt charges for Peter Navarro, formerly Trump's trade and manufacturing director, and Daniel Scavino, formerly the White House's communications chief. Rules Committee Chair Jim McGovern, a Massachusetts Democrat, alleged both men played significant roles in attempting to undermine the 2020 presidential election.
Mr. Scavino and Mr. Navarro have both bragged publicly about their efforts to overturn the election, yet neither had the courage to appear before the Select Committee.
McGovern says contempt of Congress is punishable by up to a year in prison and fines up to $100,000. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, featuring an interview with Coast Range Director Chuck Willer on how to build equitable forest economies in Western Oregon to revitalize rural communities. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear skies with a few clouds and a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 64 degrees. Today in history, in 1859, naturalist Charles Darwin sends his publishers the first 3 chapters of On the Origin of Species. Knowing the fates of scientists who had published radical theories and been ostracized, or worse, Darwin held off publishing his theory of natural selection for years. When the book appeared in November of 1859, it sold out immediately. The book laid the groundwork for modern botany, cellular biology, and genetics. The quote of the day is from English naturalist and biologist Charles Darwin, who said, quote, "It is not the strongest of the species that survives, not the most intelligent. It is the one that is the most adaptable to change." Montana officials will swap nearly 37,000 acres of state land on the Flathead Indian Reservation for federal lands elsewhere in the state. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visits a First Nation in British Columbia, and a sacred stone in a park in Lawrence, Kansas, is being returned to the Kaw Nation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana Governor Greg Gianforte has asked federal officials to start a process that will swap nearly 37,000 acres of state land on the Flathead Indian Reservation for federal lands elsewhere in the state. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the swap is part of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes federal water settlement.
In a letter to the secretaries of the U.S. Departments of Interior and Agriculture, Gianforte called for talks between the state, CSKT, and the federal government to begin. As part of the CSKT Water Compact passed by Congress in 2020, the parties have 5 years to complete the land exchange. Many of the state trust lands on the Flathead Reservation are difficult to access and are primarily used for agricultural and livestock grazing leases. Gianforte says the state aims to trade those to the tribe in exchange for land from the federal government with more access and ability to generate revenue. The final say on which state lands on the reservation will be swapped for federal properties will be up to the state land board. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently visited a First Nation in British Columbia, where an investigation is underway into deaths from former residential schools. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Trudeau also came with money for support.
Trudeau says the nearly $3 million will go to continuing support healing for those who survived the school and for those families that did not. Ottawa already provided nearly $1.5 million earlier this year for research efforts into the deaths and disappearances of children who attended the former St. Joseph's Mission Residential School near the Williams Lake First Nation in British Columbia. Trudeau also says there will be more money to come.
It's not just the history of Indigenous peoples. It's Canada's history. And it is on all of us to be part of the learning, the grieving, the truth, and the reconciliation.
Trudeau said it's also important that everything is done to make sure that all the information, all the records, be made fully available to the community to find the truth and to honor the memory of all the lives that were lost. Trudeau said he was also there to listen to the elders and community members about what the path forward looks like. He also met with school survivors and others at Williams Lake, including the chief and council members. Earlier this year, the possible remains of more than 90 bodies were found on the site of the former school. The St. Joseph's Mission Residential School closed in 1981. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A sacred stone in a park in Lawrence, Kansas is being returned to the Kaw Nation. The 25-ton stone is culturally and spiritually significant to the tribe. It was removed in 1929 from its natural location at the confluence of two creeks and dedicated to pioneers as part of the city's 75th anniversary. The Kaw Nation, the city, and community organizers are working with the University of Kansas to ensure safe relocation of the stone to land held by the Kaw Nation. On Monday, the Mellon Foundation announced a grant to help support the stone's relocation, build infrastructure at the natural site, and develop an interactive program there and at what will be the stone's former site in Lawrence. The grant is among four new monuments projects. In 2020, the foundation launched the project to assess monuments across the U.S. and to preserve the stories of those who often have been denied historical recognition. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe in New York is considering a name change. Tribal voters will have an opportunity to approve or reject the proposed new name, Akwesasne Mohawk Tribe, in a referendum in June. Years ago, tribal citizens renamed their zip code to Akwesasne. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Many medical professionals feel they have a responsibility to speak up for the climate, as climate change is a major threat to the health of people across the globe. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From extreme heat to dangerous floods, the effects of climate change can put people's health at risk. So as a family physician in Madison, Wisconsin, Claire Gervais believes she has a responsibility to advocate for climate action.
A lot of us feel a calling because of our profession to be involved in this work.
She says it starts with taking a hard look at the role of the healthcare industry itself.
Healthcare systems create about 10% of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. So we're responsible in some ways for climate change, and we really need to step up to that.
As a member of Wisconsin Health Professionals for Climate Action, she's encouraging healthcare facilities to cut carbon pollution. The nonprofit recommends that hospitals make changes, such as installing energy-efficient lights, using renewable electricity, reducing medical waste, and serving more plant-rich meals.
One really interesting example is in the surgical suite, there are certain anesthesia gases that contribute to climate change, and there are alternatives, and they're actually cheaper.
So she says reducing carbon pollution not only protects the climate and public health, but it can also help hospitals save money. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A Ukrainian effort to acquire the powerful Pegasus spyware system was blocked by Israeli defense officials as far back as 2019. Ukraine's efforts to bolster its surveillance capabilities, like strengthening its military, had support from the U.S., Israel's closest ally. But Israeli officials balked at any move that might provoke a confrontation with Russia. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
A powerful spyware known as Pegasus, manufactured and leased by the Israeli company NSO Group, is again in the international spotlight, purportedly developed to track criminals and terrorists Pegasus has also been widely used by authoritarian and democratic regimes, police agencies, and intelligence services to hack into the smartphones of human rights activists, journalists, and political opponents. NSO Group was founded by former members of the Israeli Defense Forces intelligence arm. It can only sell its technology with Israeli government approval, which means it must lobby Israel's defense ministry. Last August, the Pegasus Project, a consortium of 17 organizations and individuals, mostly journalists, made a startling revelation. The project had acquired a leaked list of 50,000 individuals around the world whose phones may have been hacked, though not necessarily penetrated. Who is using Pegasus to track enemies? Only a fraction of the 50,000 hacked phone numbers so far obtained have been examined, but that's enough to reveal that governments across the political spectrum have made use of Pegasus. Among them, Israel itself, Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, India, Germany, and Hungary. The two people closest to the murdered Saudi journalist Khashoggi, for instance, including his widow, are among those whose phones were penetrated. The Modi government in India and the Orban government in Hungary have caused uproars over their use of Pegasus to spy on critics. An Abu Dhabi state-owned investment company is an investor in NSO Group. Its ruler has used Pegasus to spy on critics. The fact that nothing in a smartphone is safe from Pegasus makes it a weapon, another piece of info war technology, and all the more insidious for being able to hide within the phone and, even if discovered, be difficult to track. Just think of all the information a smartphone contains. Contacts, passwords, text and email messages, videos, pictures. Planting bugs and wiretapping seem ancient by comparison. A technology like Pegasus conceivably can infect millions of phones anywhere, anytime, giving a government or a gang access to potentially lethal information. We're nearing the point where technology is driving conflict rather than the other way around. Satellites, drones, spyware, malware, and other forms of cyber attacks, all these enable states to compete and fight at a distance, sometimes, as we have seen with Russian and Chinese hacking gangs, using non-state actors. They pose very difficult decisions for individuals on the receiving end. Unless they're government officials, there's no way to retaliate. In the case of Pegasus, its discovery may be sufficient this time around to bring that particular technology down, but it may only encourage others to make a new version that is less detectable. Abuses of surveillance technology know no borders. Authoritarian regimes like China's and Russia's have acquired it with relative ease. Just recall China's ubiquitous surveillance system, combining facial recognition technology with DNA analysis. Russia has been using the Finnish technology company Nokia to power its surveillance of political opponents like Alexei Navalny. Companies like Nokia that create the technology in surveillance systems invariably claim that absent international regulations, they just follow the money and do business with any government or group that is willing to pay for their equipment and services, like Russia. Then, when the abuses come to light, the companies condemn them or, like Nokia, leave. Obtaining international agreement on such technologies is bound to be extremely difficult, if not impossible. Nor can these companies be relied on to self-regulate. The cat is out of the bag, perhaps never to be caught. Let's keep in mind that democratic governments can also abuse this technology. In Israel, for example, Pegasus has been the subject of a recent Israeli investigation into politically motivated hacking. NSO employees tell the newspaper Haaretz that Mossad officials frequently visited its headquarters, sometimes with foreign officials. They asked to hack certain phones with Pegasus spyware. An Israeli newspaper reported that police had used Pegasus without warrants to wiretap public figures, such as confidants of Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister. Yet the Israeli government, out of concern about Russia's reaction, reportedly rejected a request by Ukraine and Estonia to purchase Pegasus so that they could hack Russian mobile phones in the period before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. One piece of good news, the Biden administration has banned use of Pegasus. Whether other governments will do the same very much remains to be seen. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, April 5th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with the latest world events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
All right. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Hey, reach out to us if you got questions, you're enjoying the show, you want to hear somebody, maybe we're saying something you have some problems with, give me an email, andrew@coastrange.org. We want to hear from you. Appreciate all the listeners out there who've reached out. If you want to hear past episodes of the show, go to coastrange.org/coastrangeradio. And you can hear all of our past episodes. Today we've got a recurring speaker on the show, the man behind Coast Range Association. And we've got Chuck Willer here, co-director and principal researcher.